Future Commerce is brought to you by Adobe Payment Services. Adobe's payment services for Adobe Commerce and Magento Open Source empowers e-commerce merchants with secure, centralized payment processing. Learn more about what Adobe can do for you in payments at adobe.com/go/payments. Future Commerce is brought to you by Nyla. Nyla is the app that helps beauty and fashion brand operators get rid of the anxiety when it comes to developing on your Shopify store. If you worry about having a dev work on loyalty, reviews, upsells, bundling, or subscription, worry no more. Nyla's got you covered. You can get 30% off your first 3 months of Nyla at nyla.app/fast. That's nyla.app/fast. Future Commerce is brought to you by Loop. Loop helps Shopify brands like Patagonia, Princess Polly, and Chubbies to deliver hassle-free return experiences. Drive more exchanges and fewer refunds with Loop. Find out more today at loopreturns.com/futurecommerce.
Hello and welcome to Future Commerce, the podcast about the next generation of commerce. I'm Brian.
I'm Philip, and today we have, this is an unsponsored episode. I don't want to hear a single word about about our next guest. This is not native content. We just super duper like jamming with this gentleman, His Eminence, the CEO, founder of Cogzi. Welcome to the show, Adi Pinar. What's up, man?
Thanks for having me, guys. And I just want to say, I thought we'd agreed to not call me His Eminence at least part of the show. And then, and yet, like 40 seconds after agreeing to that, like you just, the killer, you know, just decided to change your mind.
I mean, what it's in your, you know, title that you put over on our guest guide. Actually,
no, he didn't do that. He didn't do that. No, we have a ton of respect for you. You're a longtime e-commerce builder. I think when I look back at the world of sort of e-commerce and the open source journey, you're certainly part of that. For those who don't know, can you catch us up on sort of who you are and what Cogzi is? Just, you know, let's lay a little bit of...
give us a little history.
Give us a little history.
So working from kind of current day back, I'm pretty much a one-trick pony, guys, in terms of I've almost exclusively professionally built software for brands that sell stuff online, businesses that sell stuff online. So I was a original co-founder in WooCommerce, WooThemes before that, before it became WooCommerce. And that's really how I found my feet and learned about online commerce, except for also selling a digital product. It was really through building WooCommerce that I learned more about, like, how do you sell physical goods online? So that was like the first stint there. I subsequently kind of left. WooCommerce got acquired by Automattic. I started a new company, which wasn't the first idea that I had. There's a failure in between there, but I started a company called Receiptful, eventually became Convergio, which was email marketing automation. Started about the same time as OmniSend, for example. At that stage, like Klaviyo and MailChimp were the big incumbents. Started the same time as OmniSend. They totally lapped us eventually on growth, but we still got to a really good exit eventually on in 2019. I sold to Campaign Monitor, spent a year there trying to vest in Pete, which is harder than what it's supposed to be. And then now I'm working on Cogzi, where we've raised a lot of capital from a bunch of really great investors to solve a really kind of your big challenge for kind of your modern retail brands, which is all around how do you manage inventory, how do you do planning, how do you forecast, how do you adapt to kind of your changes in your business or in the market. So I've been going at that for about 18 months now, and it's definitely the hardest software solution that I've tried to, when I say it, and I'm going to say try to build. I don't write any code anymore. I've got a co-founder, CTO, and a great team doing those things. But really, that kind of intellectual rabbit hole has been immense, both in terms of me being a challenge, but also like highly stimulating to try and figure this out.
That's so cool. Jeez. Yeah. Sounds like you're having a lot of fun.
Is it fun?
Most days. I mean, I think that kind of when you ask me is it fun? Where my mind impulsively goes is that with all the benefits of being, if I take out the kind of the smaller failures along the way, this is effectively my third rodeo. And both WooCommerce and Convergio were material successes that allowed me to level up in life, allowed me to diversify risk, etc. But the third time is not necessarily harder in the early stages. And I definitely thought it was going to be easier, right? I thought like, hey, here's AD, he's got reputation, he's got network, he's got all this pedigree in the ecosystem. Just find a big enough problem to solve or an obvious enough problem to solve. Build a product, you know you can do that, market it, and everything is hunky-dory. Going from zero to one remains hard. And I think as a founder, especially when you are responsible to your shareholders, you're responsible to your team members, there are some days where things don't work as hoped or planned, that is still hard. And I think the only change really from first rodeo to this is I would say that the way I manage my psychology is better, in the sense that the highs are slightly kind of lower and the lows are slightly higher. So that spectrum is like more congested. And on a day-to-day basis or hour-to-hour basis sometimes, you'll find me closer to the middle versus these extreme highs and extreme extreme lows. So yes, it's mostly fun, but not every single day or every single thing.
I can't, not having really gone through it in sort of the, you know, the serial entrepreneur journey, certainly have a very different background. But I'm now at a certain age where I am a bit more introspective, and I have a lot of data over 42 years now to look back at myself and say, I have some behavioral traits that come up every so often. Like, I get into certain scenarios. This happens all the time. And the team at Future Commerce reminds me pretty frequently, is like, you get like this in every big project that we do. Like, there's a moment where you kind of have a freak out and it'll pass, right? It'll pass and we're going to crush this, right? And so if I haven't, unlike you, I'm not at the Zen master, you know, level where I can self-regulate, but I've at least surrounded myself with a lot of people who can help regulate me. Brian, am I regulated? Am I well-regulated these days?
You're more regulated than you were.
That's the best we can hope for, right? What's your... I have to assume you've worked with Matt Mullenweg over the years. And, you know, I would make an assumption that you sort of know him fairly well, better than I do. You've been around the team that literally built the web to some degree. What are some of the things that are sort of the largest changes in mindset over the course of the last 15 years, not just in e-commerce, but just in the way that we build the web? The modern web, as we know it, we owe a ton to things like WordPress and the proliferation of that kind of software, and then making generational leaps to finding a way to actually monetize and capitalize open source software. Having all that firsthand experience, I'm curious if there's anything you can glean out of that you could share with us.
I don't speak to Matt every single day. Sure. He and I chat every now and again. What I will say is that he is undoubtedly the kind of individual, like, especially in the WooCommerce days, where our universes overlap significantly more so than what it does today. He was the kind of mentor to me, without formally having that title. So I think that kind of the way I would always describe Matt as a leader is he had this uncanny ability to find a balance between these kind of idealistic notions that go with kind of an open web, an open source, and how things should be run. And then also building a kind of a commercial vehicle that has significant enterprise value. And I think one would argue, like most critics would argue, automatic, and at least like where I can probably speak more directly or more intimately, I think if you just take WooCommerce, it is probably a subpar enterprise compared to what it should be because of balancing those two different things, right? So if enterprise value was the exclusive way to measure this, I don't think it can have reached its potential, right? But as
those
I said,
two things being the idealism of the open web versus the commercialization of the property.
Exactly, because I don't think the kind of that alignment is not always perfect and it's not always tricky. And I remember back then in the WordPress ecosystem, there would often be things that Matt or Automatic would decide that didn't make sense, in air quotes, to the rest of us, right? But it was always like, I wouldn't want to be in his position making those decisions, because I think it was always a very tricky balance. And I think, so like, he definitely has my respect for kind of threading that needle and continuing to do so, like, firstly, right? I think if, like, the biggest learning from that and seeing how kind of he operates that, and this, it's something that I now consider part of my DNA, which is really kind of the fact that a rising tide lifts all boats, right? And that we're not playing a zero-sum game here. And I think that when you are, you know, working in open source and you know that kind of your competitor can download your product and they can take your code and they can resell it and market it and do whatever they want with it, you have to find different ways of kind of your building, kind of your businesses and building technology. And I think that there is something kind of beautiful in that. There's something actually there's a African proverb that says, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you're going to want to go far, go together. So it's all these kind of different things that over the years have really, you know, coalesced for me in how I now think about entrepreneurship. And then I think if I were to kind of try and package all of that to answer your original question as to kind of what has changed and what hasn't changed, is my observation is probably the fact that we have significant technologies in our lives, i.e. mm-hmm. WordPress, that has not changed that much, right? Like, we want to think that new shiny thing is always kind of better technology. And yet, for most websites on the internet today, WordPress should still be the go-to tool, right?
It's the tool of the free press. Like,
still
free,
is.
The free press runs on WordPress. Like, legitimately, civilization runs on... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Right. So, and I think, like, if that is the only observation here, is, like, you can build a lasting solution, technology solution, doesn't have to always be the best, doesn't have to have all the latest bells and whistles, doesn't have to have artificial intelligence, machine learning kind of attached to it, doesn't have to have a kind of the most up-to-date kind of UI or UX, and it can still have a significant impact. And what I would say, and again, like, we have to detach enterprise value, because so much in tech, at least, enterprise value is a bit of a greater fool game, right? Where we have investors and private rounds kind of upping things. Like, I think, and again, like, you guys should stop me because I can go down so many tangents, right? But beyond the fact that I think, like, Elon Musk seems to have totally lost the plot in what he's doing with Twitter, if he does manage to kind of pull off this kind of these kind of deep cuts into a publicly listed kind of tech company and say, like, I can cut 50-60% of expenses and staff and still run something significant, right? There is a question around kind of how valuable tech companies really are, right? And what kind of the lead up and kind of your fundraising means for that. And my point is, maybe there's a bigger reset and an equilibrium that we kind of need to get to. Not saying Twitter is not great and worth billions of dollars, but potentially not whatever Elon decided to pay for it.
Maybe, or maybe he just figured out how to, like, cut all the fluff. Like, maybe actually, like, the core technology is all that mattered in the first place. Like, all of the other layers that were built around it, that was all, like, it didn't matter as much as, like, 280 characters. Like,
but at the same time, don't you think too, though, that and Brian, I want you to complete your thought, but don't you think too that it's just, like, fundamentally, it's a lot of luck. Like, at you know, it's like statistically improbable that you have software that has the escape velocity that, like, becomes so generationally important and has so much impact on culture. That actually, both that statement could apply to both WordPress and Twitter, I guess, to some degree. Like, these are highly unlikely scenarios that you have that sort of reach, right?
Yeah, I think a better example of this might be Microsoft. Microsoft was the epitome of enterprise software back in the day. It was like, you get locked in, everybody hated paying the Microsoft tax. It was very closed system, like, closed, like, focused on Microsoft. And you know, and as a result, you know, they lost a lot of market share, and you know, it all whittled away over the years. And then Satya came in and said, wait a minute, we're going to have a more like balanced mindset around being an open company and partnering and being like and having this high-minded thought process around the web and around technology. And as a result, Microsoft's actually flourished. Maybe this comes back to that balance. Like Elon, and I mean, I said Elon lost his way a long time ago, whatever narrative we're talking about. I know.
it's fashionable now, but we have a transcript that shows you saying it in 2018.
OG, so. Yeah. One thing I did want to get back to you on, though, two things about Matt, two separate lines of thought. I'm going to start with one, but I'm going to get to the other one later. I'm sure I'll come back to it. When it comes to like where things went in the past few years, do you feel like the high-minded people kind of lost out for a while? Like, did commercial actually advance the web faster? And you sort of already answered this question, and you said, you know, WordPress is still a significant part of the web, but I feel like the web's gotten a lot bigger. So yes, WordPress is still a significant part of it, but as a portion of the entire pie, it's smaller than it was before, or at least in the way that when someone goes to make a purchasing decision about something commercial, they're not necessarily like they're looking at more options. Maybe that's just a perception thing, and that's actually what I want to ask. Like, I think the perception is that commercial won. Do you think that's true?
I don't think it's entirely true. I think my perspective would be that the kind of the pie size has also increased, right? Like we essentially have, and I say this living in Cape Town, living on a continent where if you take technology adoption, like it's still on the rise. Like there are still more people via mobile phone, ultimately desktop, getting onto the more sophisticated internet, creating kind of a bigger size of the pie. So like, I think that firstly happens, A. B, yes, like if you take a simple kind of a direct example to WordPress, is I know, you know, Webflow is the kind of the sexy kid on the block at this stage, right? Like nobody wants to use old legacy tech in WordPress, so they pay stupid money for kind of, you know, not for Webflow itself necessarily, but for an agency that knows what they're doing with Webflow versus kind of, you know, having your, yep, your pick of, you know, 10 agencies willing to pull off a WordPress project in a very cost-efficient manner. So to that extent, like Webflow is a great company by all means. Like I have no intimate kind of knowledge there. They've carved out like their 0.6 or 0.8% of the, you know, CMS market. So there has been commercial value there, but I wouldn't say their entry itself, that's not what created a bigger pie here, right? They've just also been able to, for specific use cases, for merchants to make sense, been able to offer alternative solution or sometimes a more tailored solution based on needs. And again, the latter is probably nuanced. Like I would argue that I still don't understand why you'd use Webflow or WordPress, right? But let's assume that for some users, at least there is a very specific and valuable reason to kind of make a different choice of CMS or platform there.
Hey there, futurists. That's what we call all of our subscribers here at Future Commerce. I want to tell you about this new product from Adobe that I think might change the game. If you're a futurist, you're thinking about what the future looks like for your business to help you grow. And payment services for Adobe Commerce and Magento Open Source might be that for you. I built my career in Magento Open Source and then in Adobe's cloud ecosystem. And one of the biggest headaches that we had in helping merchants at the largest scale find the solution for payments for their business was that we had too many hands to shake and way too many options to consider. What we needed was one place to manage all of our payments for all storefronts all over the globe, with reporting and reconciliation all built in, along with automatic updates. And guess what? That's what Adobe has built with payment services for Adobe Commerce and Magento Open Source. If you are looking to take that next step in your stage of growth, if your finance team is looking to consolidate relationships, if you are looking to just streamline how you're running payments across all of your commerce sites, Adobe might be able to help you. Find out how Adobe's newest e-commerce solution can support your growth and help your business grow sustainably. You can do it with payments, and Adobe Payment Services can help you. Find out more about payment services today at adobe.com/go/payments. I think there's so I'm going to cop Brian Lang here. So what I hear you saying is that there's room for both, but as the pie gets larger, the acceleration of the growth of the pie isn't necessarily at the same rate of growth that it was maybe 10 years ago. And so the opportunity for new entrants and sort of like having these generationally, like dramatic leaps forward in technology sort of diminishes over time, because in reality, the growth rate of web usage has slowed over time too. And so you'd really don't have to be that much better to try to win over the market. You'll kind of just skim off the top, and a Webflow can easily skim off the top. One of the things I think that's really differentiating around something like a Webflow is it just the technology is incredibly impressive to me, a developer who, you know, honestly love the control that you have with a WordPress. But I also feel like I've had problems of my own with WordPress in the past. I've broken things, right? I've gotten hacked, right? There's a level of sort of minutia that after 15 years, I'm like, yeah, I just want the easy button, right? And so I do think that, like, or let me ask you this. Do you think that there's a sense of sort of the lost art, or sort of the sense that we have it too easy now, to where maybe certain skill sets and certain valuable parts of building businesses and maybe technology parts of those businesses is going to be lost to time, and that we just have a bunch of black boxes that operate on our behalf now that people don't really even have to think about inventory planning even anymore? I mean, Cogsy's just going to handle that, right? So if you never have to worry about profitability, are you actually building a business, or are you just assembling a whole bunch of black boxes in interesting ways? I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, someone still needs to build those black boxes, right?
But it's an increasingly smaller number of people, isn't it, right, that have the skill set to do so?
In my mind, that's a very utopian perspective to take, right? I think the disclaimer here is that I am not as bullish on artificial intelligence, on machine learning, as kind of many others, right? Beyond the kind of the novel things, like, don't get me wrong, like with Stable Diffusion, like I love giving it different prompts and seeing kind of what image it spits out, right? Like that's a novel experience. Like it is fun to kind of, you know, to do that. But I'm not sure that I necessarily believe that there's a future where very few humans with the help of AI is essentially creating those new black boxes. Right? Like that's the part that I am not kind of completely sold on, right? What I can say, at least if I think about, let's say Cogsy, right? Because Cogsy has a forecasting element that is a black box to our customers and to ourselves, right? Like some of the kind of the microservices we use, like it is a bit of a, well, it spits out a number, guys. Like I can tell you in theory why it spits out that number. I can't tell you exactly, this is the calculation, right? It was 1 + 1 - 2, that's 0 kind of thing, right? But in building that business, there are still so many qualitative kind of things to consider. There are non-black box things that we need to build. There are kind of customer needs that we need to understand, both from a product perspective and also how do you mesh this back to kind of market. Like those are the things that, like I don't know whether I believe in that kind of, you know, science fiction version of, you know, getting to 2050 or 2080 or where, whatever kind of year it is, where the robots just run things. I'm a bit of a, even though I regard myself as a technologist and an early adopter, I'm a bit of a contrarian kind of in that sense. Like it will continue to progress. AI, machine learning, all these things will continue to play a bigger part in our world. But I think it stops at some point where it stops before the robots take over completely.
I would argue that's because our data is too much for our linear algorithms to handle. And there's too much refactoring that would have to be done every time a new set of data came in, because eventually we will be generating more data in a single day than we have in the entire year of 2022.
Don't say it, Brian.
I'm not going to go there. But I'm also
as a whole thesis that could derail us at this moment.
I'm not going to derail us.
If you're listening and you do want to hear more about it, Brian wrote like a 4,000 word piece called Quantum Yeet. I did cut about a thousand words just to make it more digestible.
But
let's move on. Yes, we have to. We don't have the evolved thinking, is what you're saying, to even process it. Never mind the compute power,
right,
to understand.
Right, and what you're saying, AD, is that, and I fully agree with this. I think that software must be applied. Technology must be applied to situations. It must be contextualized, and that requires people to do that. And so there's always going to be like an element of like, yeah, it's not just going to all be a bunch of black boxes that will spit out bad outcomes for certain sets of people. And therefore, like those that do personalize and do apply properly are going to be able to address a larger market. But that only works at scale. For those that are struggling with scale, black boxes are great because they're cheap. And they address enough of a market to be able to go to market. And so I think that's where we've seen a lot of the rise of these black boxes.
It's interesting because AD, I want your take on this because you come from the prior era before cloud and SaaS too, right? And so I built software in the early aughts. Even like actually I was musing on Twitter yesterday, like I built software in the late 90s, but let's not talk about that. In the early aughts, you know, if you were going to fulfill e-commerce from somewhere in South Florida, there's no 3PLs within any reasonable amount of distance from us to get products to customers. Like you kind of had to build that too. You had to build everything. There was no, like SAP existed, Oracle existed, but if you were doing 5 to 10 million online, you had nothing like that. So what did you do? You built it in the LAMP stack. Like most of your business ran on Excel, and what didn't was a web interface that was crudely put together by someone named Philip Jackson, right? And so you learned intimately the certain parts of the business that you needed to succeed, and you never built more than that because you didn't have the time. And so you got really good at fulfillment, even though you didn't want to. You got really good at software development, even if you didn't want to. Right? You got really good at marketing and demand gen, even if you really didn't want to. What you really wanted to do was create great products. But to create great products, you had to have all the other stuff too. Now we don't need to have any of that stuff, and we still can't make good products. So I'm not really sure how to to reconcile them. Like it is all black boxes all the way down to some degree, but maybe we're poorer for it is, I guess, what I'm trying to say.
I'm there for that brand, by the way. Like we're a similar age, so I definitely had that when I'm not fully kind of optimistic. I have that sense of kind of jadedness about me as well. I suspect, Phil, that there's parts of this that were in business, but let's stick to kind of in tech and business. We seem to have come to a conclusion that there's actually a universal playbook for how to do these things. And it's just a scientific, like here's a 7-step process. This is how you build a business and become a billionaire. And I think the thing that's lacking there is that part of this will always be art, what I would call art, right? Which is the qualitative, the creative, the parts where like me as a unique individual, like I am able to connect to dots that a machine simply cannot do, right? So I think that's, at least that's where my head goes here. Hence why I don't think it's easier to build a product or a business today than it was 20 years ago. Like functionally or logistically, it's easier, right? Like to your point, like you can now spin up, like if you are a seller online, like within a few clicks, regardless of your platform of choice, you can have a fully functional website with a product listed on it that has a checkout enabled with like 4 different, payment processing options. Like that's pretty easy. Like it's a 15-minute job for someone that has a rudimentary understanding of how to sign up for a cloud-based thing. That doesn't create a business yet, right? Like that doesn't, like, how do you find the product? So again, like there's ways to find a product. There's ways to ask friends and say, hey, I need to source a product from Asia. Where do I start? Right. But all of those things, like it's not a simple kind of process, right? And even anyway, like, again, like, I can go down to kind of that rabbit hole to the nth degree. There's parts of this that simply like does not replicate perfectly from the one business to the next. Like, there is no playbook. And as I said, like, I would firmly argue that success in business and in life comes from that balance of both science and art.
Loop helps Shopify's most loved brands like Chubbies and Patagonia and Princess Polly to deliver hassle-free return experiences. You don't need to make returns difficult for your customers. There's no need. Instead, automate your return process so that you can drive more exchanges, increase upsell value, and reduce refunds with Loop. Learn more about Loop today at loopreturns.com/futurecommerce. Nyla is the stunningly fast way to deliver on your goals with your Shopify store. If you are in beauty or CPG or fashion, then you know that putting your devs on your subscription or bundling or upsell project can give you a splitting headache. Nyla is like an aspirin for you. You don't ever have to worry about devs on your project ever again. Doesn't matter what it is, gift with purchase, loyalty, reviews, it's all covered in 2023 when you put your trust in Nyla. You can join brands like Supergoop, Topicals, and Alder Apparel that are already putting e-commerce to the test in a stunningly fast way with Nyla. Get 30% off your first 3 months with Nyla by mentioning Future Commerce and visiting nyla.app/fast. That's nyla.app/FAST and tell them Future Commerce sent you.
So this is the typical conversation when we start talking about, you know, art in our space, is the value that you sort of place on art is extremely subjective for sure. But I think that there's a lot of objective criteria by which you could judge art. For instance, you know, a few very large format, highly detailed pieces takes a physical, like physically takes a longer amount of time than a lot of process art. You know, you see a lot of stuff on like Instagram and TikTok today. I'm talking about actual physical artwork, you know, where people are doing splatter paintings and such. And I think while that's interesting and makes for great content, the rate at which they produce pieces, you know, potentially devalues the whole body of work to some degree, right? Maybe one or two truly stand out. The thing that they're actually learning over time is not necessarily how to be a great artist. It's how to be an amazing content creator because they show up every day. Mm-hmm. So they're developing a skill, but maybe it's not the skill they think they're developing. And that's where I feel like we're in a transitionary period in the web where operators and builders are building skills, but it's not the skill that they think they're building. They're building another skill. They're building a skill of how to think about disparate parts of the world and bring them together into unified experiences, but not necessarily the skill that you and I and Brian might have built 15 years ago, which is software development's really hard. Getting people to work in concert together is really hard. Defining requirements is really hard. Working under the, you know, the onus of compliance is really hard. You know, protecting your site from baddies is really hard. Setting up meetings with freaking banks so you can like finance your business is really hard. All of that's getting easier. And we all develop different skill sets as a result. I'm not saying that the kids are soft today. I'm saying that they're building fundamentally different skill sets.
So speaking of one of those,
right.
Speaking of those skills, I want to get back to the second question that I referred to earlier in the episode. So working with Matt, I'm assuming that you did, you said he was sort of an unofficial like mentor for you. And I'm assuming this means that you worked in an asynchronous context. Like a lot of your communication was, you know, not live. I'm curious, you know, this is a skill set that everyone's had to learn in the past few years. And it's something that, you know, many of us did have to learn, you know, a little bit earlier, just being in technology. But I would love to get your take on what it means to build a business asynchronously right now. I think that there's a lot of benefits. There's also a lot of drawbacks, And then also just like general thoughts on asynchronous communication in general. Like I wrote a piece about how e-commerce in itself is asynchronous. It's an asynchronous purchasing modality. How do you feel that like that people are engaged in these distanced and like time, like where time is, or distance engagements where time is unbound, if you will?
Yeah. So I think it's interesting, Brian, like mentioning like how commerce is asynchronous and in nature. Like the reason why that's the case is, I think part of the kind of the whole concept of why asynchronous exists is, I think, very aligned with where we're at as a society, which is we are very individually focused, right? Like we're happy to accept individuals for whatever kind of, you know, trait they have or preference they have, et cetera. Like we're trying to be accommodating. I think, like, I'm obviously speaking, you know, stereotyping here, but we have doubled down on this concept of individuality. And if you think about asynchronous anything, whether it's commerce or communication, it ultimately is like, hey, you can ping me, you can send me a message, and I will respond based on my set of criteria, availability, my time, my priority, et cetera. Might also mean that I'm sometimes a bit of a dick, right? Because I don't respond to my mom quick enough when she texts me, right? Yep. But the concept, like, again, so there's a different balance there between my needs as an individual and how I am a functional contributing part of a collective, right? In various kind of contexts there. So, but I think for me, that kind of trend makes total sense. Beyond that, like I tend to have a bit of a bias, right? Like, so when I stepped down as WooCommerce CEO, the team was about 40 people. We had a small office in Cape Town, about 10 of us. The other 30 team members were scattered all over the world. And that configuration is, I think, for teams are actually the hardest. So where you have the hybrid of kind of a remote team and a co-located team, I think that's the hardest, because you essentially need to have more discipline to not just work to kind of Brian's desk and have a little powwow around something and then no one else knows about this. Whereas if everything is remote and all communication or most communication is async, that gets captured somewhere and everyone is in the loop. And I don't have to remember to have the discipline of, hey guys, like I had a chat, I walked over to Brian's desk and we had this chat, this decision, FYI for everyone, right? So I think that's the first thing that I'll say. But then Convergio was fully distributed and remote from day one. And same with Cogsy today. And part of the kind of, I think, a superpower, by the way, is Stefano is now my CTO and co-founder. He was also my first engineering hire at Convergio. So like he and I, right or wrong, we just have a very specific way of how we do kind of remote working and asynchronous communication. What I will say is I over-index for people that can write well. I think it's much easier. It's much easier to kind of to come on here, for example, and spitball things, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you kind of, there's an energy to it. And if someone listens to it, they can somewhat get lost in energy. But I don't think that necessarily leads. This medium is great for storytelling, for example, because there's a bit more kind of voice and tone and kind of a flow to it. Mm-hmm. But if you really want to communicate clearly, whether it's to sell, whether it's to persuade, whether it's to ask a question, the written word is so much better. And I think doing that asynchronously means that you're also thinking about it, like you're editing yourself. It's not just this constant fire hose of ideas, et cetera, like I'm doing whenever I'm asking, answering a question here. Like if you sent me this as a kind of a list of text questions, I would have edited this much better. To your point, like what about quantum yeet?
Like, you asked for that like five times, by the way.
You edit the thing, right? So I think like, again, like I over-index for it. I don't think it's the necessarily the right way. And there's probably a preference thing in there as well. Like some individuals should work on some teams that have a bigger synchronous component and perhaps an in-person component. Like that's perfectly fine as well. I just have a strong preference and bias towards kind of doing so and communicating asynchronously. Mm.
I do think you're onto something with the writing component. That was sort of my point in my article, is that you have to be good at writing, and not just writing, but like you have to be good at storytelling in the written word, and that takes a certain kind of person. Like you have to have a certain skill set to be able to do that. I would argue that e-commerce is actually in the same boat, both from the purchasing and from the selling perspective. Like, it yeah. requires a certain type of person to do it well. And so, yes, buyers are like, it's a little simpler. It doesn't require as much skill set to be a buyer, except for it does, because returns are a huge problem. And satisfaction with purchase is still a big problem. And so there's a, you know, I think it really does require a skill set on both sides in order to do it well. And I think especially coming out of the pandemic, you know, we're seeing a lot of people that were had a hard time adopting that skill or weren't built to do things that way, coming back and sort of changing how they want to work with people, how they want to interact with people. And it's probably why we saw some of the attrition we saw for online purchasing, would be my guess. It's not so much about adoption. It's about how people want to or need to exist.
And to your point earlier, Brian, about how skills are changing, right? Like when I think about kind of your commerce and the skills that are needed, like the one I'll throw in there is discovery, right? I think, for example, mm-hmm. I think I'm a good Googler. Right. Like if I need to find information or something, I think that there's a specific skill. And yes, Google has kind of made it easier over time with suggestions and kind of allowing you to go down certain kind of rabbit holes. But like knowing what to ask the machine, and again, like talking about black boxes, like knowing what to ask the machine, that's a critical skill, right? Like, so you're not just communicating with humans, you're communicating with machines these days.
Right.
And again, like using the Stable Diffusion kind of example, like if you're asking for a nice picture or something, the way you speak to a machine is different to how you would speak to a human artist, right? To do a commission kind of work. And I actually think, like when I think about my kids, for example, and what skills they should be learning, like those are the kinds of skills that I think are helpful. Like, hey guys, like this is what a good search query looks like, for example. Right.
Yeah.
So like to that extent, yes, like the core technology is probably not changed significantly, but we're probably at that stage now where there's a massive step change in the skills that you need to apply to use the same technology.
Yes. Totally agree. Yeah, my kids are being trained by Alexa. So
this is where I said we're kind of at this inflection point where we've had 150 years max of QWERTY and maybe 40 years of mass adoption of QWERTY, meaning like this one method of human, you know, device interface is fairly new as far as human communication is concerned. And that's just one way that we interact with other people online. That's the one method by which we put in, you know, put our thoughts into the written word. This idea of communication medium, 100 years ago, we were still using the telegraph. And so we have so rapidly changed the way that we communicate, commerce or not. Like we've so rapidly evolved the way that we communicate. We are developing a new set of skills, and there are ways of thinking and styles of learning that will be just by nature and sort of Darwinian evolution will be at the disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And so prompt engineering is a good example of that, is that it requires a great deal of not just understanding how the machine responds to your input. It's not just a slot machine where we're going to pull the crank. It's having enough understanding of how the machine responds to your input that you'll gain a new skill that has never existed in the world, in the same way that I've developed the skill to Google for things over the last 15, 20 years, in the same way that my kids are now learning how to navigate Alexa in a way that I cannot do. They're incredibly efficient with it. Progress is not slowing down. If anything, it's accelerating. And to your point, Brian, there are people who will be at the disadvantage and potentially even left behind in a technological revolution. And I think the question is like, does our sense of individuality mean that we have to, as a society, decide no man left behind, or will we just progress forward, march forward? We're heading towards some sort of Elysium future, and there's going to be, you know, some massive divide of people who are technologically capable and those who are not.
Yes, I have a huge concern around that. I think I'm like very kind of very humanitarian or human first in that kind of thinking. Hence why I probably kind of also limit myself to believe that we will get to that sci-fi future where the robots are kind of doing everything. Because I think when I consider, again, like many of us would use different kind of words here, but I also always consider the kind of, what is the spirit of being human? And I think that part of being human is that we are a social creature. Like we care about our neighbor, like inherently so. Like Sometimes they're being dicks and we don't like them as much, right? Sometimes they vote differently than us and we have a kind of a debate about politics, and that's like we differ. But like none of us, I bet, want to be alone on this earth. So I think it is a case of building technology in a responsible way going forward, and not being so gung-ho. So maybe the last kind of the last thought that I'll leave there then is I'm not the kind of technologist that says we need fewer regulations, for example. I'm also not the one that says we need all the regulations. I don't think that this kind of unfettered kind of just gung-ho-ness that we've seen from some major tech companies in recent years, especially that kind of typical kind of, let's break stuff kind of mentality that came out of Silicon Valley. I don't think that that is healthy, for example, because we're essentially giving single human beings decision-making power over things that affect us greatly, right? So if you consider something like Facebook, it probably started with some kind of noble kind of ambition, definitely not a malicious one. Yet it was never regulated to the extent where we are today, where like we have kind of teenage depression being at all-time highs. That was technology and building dark patterns in technology for user adoption, which is perfectly fine, where we never considered what the kind of the byproduct or the consequence of the unintended, maybe unintended. Like, I don't think this is malicious. So as we think about the evolution of technology and society, I think it's all of our responsibility to look each other in the eye and say, listen, you're like, some people can't reskill quickly enough. We need to like take some other approach here.
This makes me want to talk with you for like another hour and remind me.
Yeah, we have to do this again.
That I want to read, which is called The Human Use of Human Beings, called Norbert Wiener. That is on my list. And I cannot wait to get there. AD, what a great place to leave it though.
Thank you. What a great way. There's no way to wrap up the stream of conscious. And
no, it's so good.
I don't think we would have gotten here had we prepared a list of questions, not to excuse our bad behavior for podcast hosting. But it's been a pleasure to have you. Where can people find you online and potentially maybe connect with Cogsy should they want a black box to work on their inventory?
Totally. So the best places is at AD on Twitter, so ADII. Otherwise, Cogsy is just cogsy.com. Comes from cost of goods sold. Anyone in the space like should be able to easily make that connection.
I would hope so. We'll help you. We don't want to leave you behind. Let us know. Thank you so much, AD. Thank you so much for listening to Future Commerce. You can find more episodes of this podcast and other Future Commerce properties. There's six of them now over at futurecommerce.fm. And we'd love to have you. And don't miss a thing. We've got our event coming up in Miami in just about a week and a half when you listen to this. And can't wait for us to see you there. If we do see you there, let us know. It's at Art Basel on December 1st. We're launching Archetypes, and you can go get your ticket, or you can get the book and other assorted merchandise from Archetypes, our new 240-page print journal and collection of writings that talk about brands and the roles that they play in our world. You can get that at archetypesjournal.com. Thank you so much for listening to Future Commerce.